Welcome to Sake Deep Dive, the sake podcast for the beyond beginner. I am your host, Jim Ryan, a guy you might know from the book Discovering Yamaguchi Sake or good old Twitter back in the day when it was a thing. Joined as always by my friend and co-host, Andrew Russell. How you doing tonight, Andy?
I am good, Jim. Delighted to be back for another episode. It somehow feels like it's been a while since we did one, but it's that isn't the case.
Yeah, it does. We don't keep that wide a gap open, but it just seems to be getting longer. Maybe it's just getting older. Every day seems to be
That could
more
be
than the last.
Yeah, that could be the sad but true reality for both of us, Jim.
Yes, don't. Yeah, kids out there, don't get old if you can help it. So, Andy, you're still working up at Kenbishi. The season seems to be winding down.
It is indeed. Yeah, it's been a funny old season. Like I just said to you before we came on air, not necessarily a bad thing, but it has been surprisingly smooth sailing this year. So, yeah, I shouldn't complain really. But another month or so, and then we'll be finished home and try and get back to normal life where I don't have to get up at 5 in the morning every day and work till 9 in the evening.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's a smooth adjustment. All right. So I guess if you're reaching the end of the season, then it's time for Kenbishi to press and bottle all of that sake. Each tank's going to be pressed and bottled on its own, right? No sake comes in contact with another. Is that's how it works, right?
Jim, you continue to amaze me with these segues.
I have a gift. It's a gift, Andrew.
It is. They're getting better and better every month, I have to say. So I take my hat off to that one. No, Jim, of course, that is not the case. Kenbishi have a very specific way of brewing or preparing their sake, which is not unique and which is not new, but it is rarer than it used to be. And it is, of course, for anyone that knows Kenbishi anyway, the process of blending.
I'm sorry, Andy. Wait. There's this guy. There's a couple of guys actually who keep saying that blending doesn't happen in sake until they came along. Are you telling me that they're wrong?
I really don't know how to put it in a nice way. Emphatically, yes, they are wrong.
Yeah. As you might be already able to tell, this is going to be a little bit more, how do we say it? Assertive an episode? I don't know. I believe that someone asked us to cover the topic of blending in sake. And we said yes without really thinking deeply about how it was going to go. Because I think Andy and I both sort of basically said the research for this just made us mad. It's just because the topic of blending in sake is a really odd kind of thing. It wasn't a topic, as in it wasn't something that even people thought about until these, I think we can probably just say it, until, you know, the Iwa 5 from Richard Geoffroy and Tanaka, what is it? Tanaka 1789 X Chartier came along with these blended sakes, what they call using that wine technique. Idea of assemblage, and both of these sort of, I guess, public relations flurries, the things that they started talking about, they both basically stated flat out, and I'm not intimated, like they stated that there was no history of blending in sake and that they were the first to do it and that they were going to, you know, revolutionize sake through this idea. And like sort of the sake industry just kind of said, oh yeah, rather than responding with any kind of, you know, correction, which is of course that blending sake is quotidian. Like it's about as common as you could get in terms of like something that happens that's not in a technical book, which is I think the problem, right? So the research was rather difficult to do because nobody really talked about it. It was just something that everyone was doing. Yeah, and so the process of researching for this particular episode was an unusual one for us. But I don't know about you. I've did a lot of research for this before. I wrote an article about this for Sake Times back when it was still pretending to be a journalistic kind of enterprise, and I ended up just having to interview people because there wasn't a lot of documentary research available. But I don't know, Andy, did you have any better luck?
Well, the interesting thing about this topic is normally when we decide on a topic, personally I Google in Japanese because the quality of information obviously is night and day when you Google something about sake in Japanese compared to English. But this was an interesting one, and for the reasons that you just said there, if you Google the term in Japanese, not a lot comes up. A lot of the books that we rely on for this show, the ones that we use quite frequently, there's not much written about it in there as well. But if you Google the topic in English, and by the way, I do not recommend it, then you are going to get a lot of articles. But with the exception of the one that you wrote, if you have any understanding about the production process of sake, it is going to be very painful to sift through these. But it's also quite demoralizing as well because these articles are so badly researched. If you think part of writing an article surely should be not just to take one person's opinion and then just run with it, but to actually do a bit of background check, but virtually every single one of them hasn't done that, which to me just sounds crazy. And it made me lose faith in some of these highly respected, institutions that give us news and things like that. The quality of these articles was just so poor. So hopefully we can clear this up tonight and give a more balanced and realistic or take a more realistic approach to this topic. But I just want to say as well, I'm not going to use the word assemblage more than once tonight. I refuse to be implicit in this renaming of things with obscure French terminology from the wine world when there's perfectly good words for them in English and Japanese. The enjoyment of sake should not be dependent on learning a foreign language. But if you do want to take it to that level, surely the best strategy would be to learn the Japanese terms. So in Japanese, the term is chogo, and that just simply translates into English as meaning mixing, compounding, or blending. And there is no difference between the French terminology that one of these companies is using and the meaning within the sake industry. It is varied, there's different styles, but that one word does cover that word, which I'm no longer going to say.
I think one of the sort of the issues that comes across in how to address this as a topic is that even the terms in English and in French, yeah, if we call it blending or if we call it assemblage or if we use chugo in Japanese, they're extremely wide open. Like they're really quite varied in what sort of specifics they mean. Like, I had to study up just a little bit on what they talk about in terms of the French industry. And what I found is basically anytime two different things come together in winemaking, they just call it assemblage. And here's just a quick little thing from a website called All Wines of Europe. I found something similar on the Bordeaux region's sort of official group homepage that it says, winemakers employ various techniques during the assemblage process to achieve their desired results. Skip ahead. Blending can be done at different stages of the winemaking process. Some winemakers prefer to blend the grapes before fermentation, while others choose to blend the wines after fermentation and aging. Basically, It's just anytime two things come together is what assemblage means. Now, obviously, when we think of someone, who's made a huge name for himself, like Geoffroy, he has a very specific idea of what he's doing. Obviously, his palette is the deciding factor, and how he uses that is going to really decide everything about it. But there doesn't seem to be anything particularly special about this. Like, it doesn't seem to be unique or unusual. And so, from that basis, right, looking at the sake industry, I mean, just even before we get started with any detailed discussion, we can categorically say that every single possible way of interpreting the term blending is used in sake and has been used in sake for a very long time, right?
Absolutely. And obviously, we should address the elephant in the room that I am employed for half the year at Kenbushi. I mean, it isn't a secret. Anyone can find out how Kenbushi do their blending on their website, on any of the presentations that the owner has done, on any of the partners that support Kenbushi around the world that have these official explanations that they give. They're out there. So nothing I say tonight is going to be a secret or new information. But like what you just said, I also found that source about the definition of the word that we're not going to use tonight. And it was from the Bordeaux Association or something, whoever they were. It's clear that the term is quite a loose term. It isn't sort of something very specific where you have to tick this box or it doesn't comply to it. It literally just does mean blending. And if you look at Kenbushi, they don't throw sake together because they're trying to homogenize the sake. That I've heard that argument from people. People say, well, this blending from these two French companies, or these two French gentlemen, is different because they're doing it stylistically. And that's an incredibly arrogant thing to say. That isn't them that are saying that, by the way. That this is people that I've heard say that. So what you're saying by making that statement is that there's no thought put into the blending process from Japanese sake makers. Now, blending of that sort does exist. I've seen that done. I've participated in that kind of blending before. That does happen. And it's not, again, it's not a secret. It's not something anyone would hide. But for example, when you make Futsu-shu typically caters to a local market. These are people that have been customers for generations. And a lot of that sake does not leave the vicinity of the brewery. And they're often a different type of consumer. They want consistency. So what they'll do is they will blend together each batch of sake to homogenize the taste, and that way you keep your local clientele happy. Now, that is quite clearly a different, although it's blending, it is a different kind of blending from these new variations that we're seeing. But that's not why Kenbushi blend. Kenbushi blend to get to a specific recipe. The brewery is famous for adhering rigidly to this recipe that they've honed over the years. And it goes back to some of the recipes go back to the Edo period. And they have to use these blending techniques to keep it the same. But they are aiming for a specific taste. It is not homogenization from that sense. And they do use different rice varieties, for example. You know this, Jim. It's actually in your article, I believe. You know, they use some omachi, for example. They use Yamada Nishiki. They obviously use the phantom rice, the Kenbushi rice, Aiyama, that has become famous with other users. So these rice varietals are all put together, blended together to get to a specific result. And that is stylistic.
And I would go further to say, like, when we look at something or like Kenbushi, what they have established is they have established a house style and then specific I guess you would say expressions for the individual labels, right? So, you've got Mizuho and what's the other really expensive one?
Zuisho.
Zuisho. They have their own characters, and then those characters are built out of individual pieces that have been aged for different periods, that have been made from different rice, that have been used, that have been made in different processes. You've got Honjozo, you've got Yamahai, and so on. And so it again, what they've got is this aesthetic style that has been set, and then every year they work to express that style using the pieces that they have created in the past, right? And you can't call that anything other than, a stylistic blend. It's not willy-nilly dumping things together. So, I think one of the interesting things about what I've seen in a lot of sake blending discussion in Japan, sort of from people who are doing it, is this idea of age and how different elements will be aged for different periods, sort of to bring that level of expression, right? Aging sake can be a little bit of a hit or miss, a little bit of a unpredictable process, but by doing this, by having different sake aged for different periods, you have different, I guess, colors in your palette when you mix them together. Kenbishi is the biggest one. The article that I wrote talked about Sohomare in Niigata doing something very, very similar, although with daiginjos, Kimoto daiginjo that they age for a variety of years. Every year they bring out the bottles that have been aging and then taste them to mix them together to create a new style for that year. So, all we have that's, not represented is one singular individual with a big name guiding this process of mixing together disparate sake expressions into one final piece.
Yeah, but we should point out though that doesn't mean they don't have blenders.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
I mean,
Yeah.
Kenbishi have a blender. They have a team of blenders, and that is their sole purpose within the organization. I don't know about Sohomare, but it sounds like they do. If they're doing complex blending of that sort, where they're blending daiginjos
Yeah.
and different ages and stuff like that, Kenbishi also. They have to take into account rice polishing percentages as well because they do their own rice polishing. So they have an idea of how the rice is going to behave just by how it behaves in the rice mill. So they have to make sometimes minute, sometimes greater adjustments on the fly each year, and that requires different levels of polishing, and that is also a part of blending quite naturally. So yeah, that element. That figurehead that these two companies have is also not unique because these other companies are using head blenders as well. And to say that it's different, I don't know, Jim, maybe it is just me, but we've talked about this before. There does seem to be this pervasive, I don't know, it's like a cultural superiority
Yeah.
that French wine is the pinnacle of brewing and Japanese sake making is this lesser thing that it's not a two-way exchange, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's no winemakers trying to emulate sake brewing. And can you imagine if a sake brewer or a famous brewery in Japan was to go over and start telling French winemakers how to do their job, and they came up with something that was quite clearly established in the winemaking world, and said we're going to be unique and we're going to do this, but it's different because we're doing it. That hasn't happened. So it does seem to me that there's this real kind of one way. We're at the top and you're at the bottom. But that's maybe I'm being unfair. That's just how I seem to be reading the situation.
I would say in the very specific situation of at least these two companies, and just to sort of clarify, Chartier is actually French Canadian. He's from Montreal. He's not French French, but I remember when I was doing my original research for the article, there was some story about a speech that he gave to at a winemaker's convention that was literally just mocking sort of standard sake procedures. He made jokes about how brewers were polishing their rice, and he said, "Can you imagine you throw away half of your grapes when you make wine?" And it's just a very it's just a very condescending attitude towards sake making that just seems to be predicated on the idea that it's better because we do it. It's better because, we have this wine making tradition, and that's what makes us gives us this authority to tell you that what you've been doing all along is different, and that we know better than you. So yeah, I don't think you're imagining it. I think it's pretty evident that it's there. And it's just completely unfounded. And I feel sad that there aren't more people on the Japanese side who are vocal about it.
Yeah,
It's
like I said there, I always try and imagine the opposite scenario. If a sake maker went to France and started saying, "Well, we've come up with this idea that the French have never been smart enough to think of. It's a sparkling wine, and we're going to bottle it in a specific region, and we're only going to use specific grapes, and it's rev we're going to revolutionize the sparkling wine industry." People would lose their minds if that happened. But as again, as I think, as someone commented, maybe it was Horie Sensei, that I think the reason that this wasn't challenged more is Japanese people don't really talk about it much. It's such a fundamental part of the industry, and maybe one that, for whatever reason, hasn't been that appealing to the Japanese. Maybe they haven't seen much interest in it. It is just a standard procedure that has been done, not by all the breweries. It's just one of many styles, or one of many groups of mythologies that's been honed over the centuries, I guess.
I had my own kind of theory about it, that it might be sort of a hesitance that dates back to the Okeuri shock of the 70s. Because, I mean, obviously they were just taking sake that was made all over there and mixing it together. And maybe just the idea of like, oh, it wasn't made in this one place. You're just mixing a bunch of different sake together and selling it to us. Maybe that idea kind of muddied the water and spoiled the image of blending. But I don't know. I was never able to confirm that. Horie, I did talk to Horie Sensei about this, and he said, it sounds plausible, but there's no way to check. The comment that you just mentioned was actually from Kono-san at Soho Mare Shuzo. He's the Kuramoto and head of the blending team there, who said that, it's just so basic that it's not even worth talking about, maybe.
So I think, so that we don't sound like a broken record in this, because we're both going to be on our soapbox all night, we've established that blending categorically is nothing new. There is also no difference between how these two winemakers, or past winemakers, now sake makers, are doing it compared to some breweries are doing it in Japan. So I think now would be a good time to talk about that history, that very long, rich history of blending in Japan.
So one of the earliest sort of records that I became aware of was from talking to the owner of your brewery, Masataka Shirakashi of Kenbishi, who told me that they actually have notes from some of the Toji back in the Edo period, a good 400 or 500 years ago, talking about how they would mix fresh sake with older sake because, the older sake was had more demand, people wanted it more, it sold better. But of course, older sake, it needs time to age, and that means stocks are automatically limited. So you add fresh to make sure that you have stocks. Now, obviously, we don't know how aesthetically focused they were on that. We don't know, were they tasting and blending, it just the fundamental concept of blending sake. But then another discussion I had was with our good friend, the friend of the show, Eternal Source, Professor Horie Shuji, who told me that in Tokyo, where all of this Kudare sake was going during the Edo period from Nara, the sake sellers, they would be getting sake from all over the place, and it was just basically coming in these tanks. And to compete, like, they developed a house style where they would, basically mix their own blend. They would get the sake that they had, mix it to their own interests or to the interests or the taste, the palates of their customer base, so that it would be more, easier to match with the more cosmopolitan cuisine that was growing in Edo of the period. And so that was a development of, I think you can only call it that aesthetically guided blending that, I think is now more to the hallmark of the French wine thinking. So, it's difficult to be certain of exactly what was going on how it was going on, but there is, I think, evidence that we did have this aesthetically guided, this flavor guided blending as long ago as the Edo period.
And just to go slightly off topic, because it's not really blending related, but the influence that these, it's called sakitonya in Japanese, these retailers, distributors that were based in Edo, they have a bit of a history of taking sake and not revealing the source of the sake. The names would sometimes be, would often be concealed. And like you said, they would other there were other things being blended, namely sake was being cut with water quite often, and probably the less scrupulous sakitonyas, they would have been making some pretty bad stuff. And this is where the term kingyoshu comes from. It literally means goat. How would you translate this? Why do I always end up speaking to a professional translator and doing the translation? So yeah, like goldfish sake, I guess is how.
Sake that was so thin that a goldfish could swim in it. And it's basically just water.
Correct. Yeah, and that term has popped up at various times throughout sake's history, but that is also one of them. But of course, that's a different kind of blending. We'll not go too far down that route.
And so then, I think, that's blending at the production level, that's blending at the sales level. So I mean, from those roots, then we basically, again, there's just not a lot of records of what's going on in between then and now. But I don't know that we can make any assumption other than that, people were still blending for all of those hundreds of years, and now they still are. What I find interesting are things like very, very specific blends. Say, I know that lots of breweries, I mean, lots of breweries probably, I don't know. We're getting close to a majority. We'll make sake that blends two different yeasts. And what that means is not that the two yeasts are working together in the same tank. I think that's probably pretty unusual, but they cr basically use the same production approach for two different batches of sake using two different yeasts. Yamaguchi Powerhouse Toyo Bijin does that. By mixing, say, 1801 and 9H, which is a local variant of the 9. So you've got those really big aromatics for the Junmai Daiginjos from the 1801, and then with sort of a bit more richness, a bit more of the depth that lower numbers like 9 or 7 even bring. Obviously, mixing rice is common. I mean, it's really hard to think of a brewery that doesn't do some kind of mixed rice where you'll have, say, particularly in terms of the koji, will be a more expensive rice like Miyama Nishiki or Ayama, filled out by something like a little bit more common and easier to get hold of, say, Yamada Nishiki. Not at all unusual. We've got, obviously, people are mixing different ages. We've talked about that already. People are mixing different kinds of styles. Like you'll have a Kimoto that you add some Bodaimoto to, or it, basically anything you can think of. There are people who are doing it and have been doing it. So.
And there's some very successful ones as well. One of the probably lesser known types of blending is different stage of pressing. And this is actually a really interesting one because it sometimes yields some incredible results. And it certainly made me think or reevaluate my own opinion of, and my own maybe initial snobbery to some types of sake. So when I first started making sake, you obviously hear when you do pressing for the first time, you hear about the different stages of them. You know, there's the first run, arabashiri, and then there's naka, which is the middle part. This is supposed to be the first part is the common description you hear is it's kind of rough but very juicy and fresh and what have you. And then you have the naka part, which is the best part. That's the prime part that they say. And then they have the last part, which is called seme. Now, I'd heard from a number of people that this was bad. This was the bad part of the press. So it's common to see first press sake. There's loads of varieties of that all over Japan. Normally, if they want to boast about something on the label, they'll say that it's the naka part. That's the middle part. You often get that with pricier daiginjos, but rarely will you see the term seme on the bottle because the image of it is it's the worst part. It's the dregs. But actually, there's some fantastic sake, and I remember when I lived in Okayama, for a brief, very brief moment, there was a bit of hype started to get built up about seme, and people said we need to really start reevaluating what this stuff is and whether we, you know, what our opinion is on it. And when I went to Hiroshima, I fell in love with a sake that was, I'm told, is a blend of exclusively seme sake, and these are normally it's all kinds of stuff. These were daiginjos mixed in with junmais. The brand is called Hoken. It's one of the you know, if you say that to people that are in the know about sake, Hoken is a brand that people are very, very fond of. It's kind of trendy within Hiroshima as well. And they do a sake called Retro Label, and I remember it was very difficult to get hold of when I lived in Hiroshima, and I had to ask a favor from a sake shop. They only sold it in places like Hasegawa. These are the really glitzy Ginza based and all the upmarket parts of Tokyo. It's a very exclusive chain of sake retailers, and they were sending it all to Hasegawa and places like this. Very little was left over for the local population. But that's a complete U-turn on people's expectations. And one of the reasons for that was it was entered into a sake competition, which are literally, I think it's called the sake competition. It's one of the, you know, more recent ones, and it won top prize, and it was a blend of seme. Now, they've not just thrown that together. They've put in some thought. It was exquisite. It was perfectly balanced. So that is another very, very interesting form of blending. And I guess from that, it should be abundantly clear by now that if there is a possibility for blending, the Japanese have done it.
So yeah, I it just is a it's a disappointment to me that people are so quick to believe obvious hype that ignores the historical realities of sake as a drink, you know. And I guess there is, like, I suppose there is some kind of benefit to this talk, just in the case that it does open an avenue for discussion, but I don't know if the discussion is fruitful or not. Like, have you, I don't know, have you
Yeah,
seen any?
I mean, I guess that you're right. There is a positive element to it in that probably a lot of consumers in Japan wouldn't have paid that much attention to the production process. The fact that that has become this topic, and it's been quite a controversial topic for all the reasons we've just talked about. I think that if anything, it has got tongues wagging about this supposed revolution in sake. I mean, by the way, these are words that are on their website. You know,
Right.
these are words that were the headlines of these articles. Yeah, one I think one of the articles said the new art of sake blending, and a lot of them started off by saying that, in fact, almost all of them, I'm being polite, started off by saying that blending was common in whiskey and, you know, other beverages, and of course
Yes.
wine. Of course it was popular in wine. Wine is where it all started, etc., etc. But now it's in sake as well. So that is how it's been framed, and I think you're going to probably divide people into two camps. That people that go, "Well, hang on a minute, that's nonsense," are the people that go, "Oh, that's interesting. Did we not do that before in sake?" And hopefully, there's someone that knows on hand and say, "No, actually, sake has done that." And all publicity is good publicity, as they say. So maybe it has got some people maybe looking into sake and put sake on the spotlight a little bit, but.
Yeah, I guess it just comes down to attention, right? They're putting attention where maybe it wasn't getting it before, but they're doing it by saying things that aren't true.
Yeah, and by the way, we should just say, I mean, that people are perfectly free to brand like that. That, you know, this is Japan is a capitalist country. You know, that is just simply marketing, as we know. We've already, as sake drinkers, have already had to suffer through the terroir nonsense of the past the past 5 or 6 years. This is just the next thing that will be most likely forgotten about within a few years, and they'll move on to something else.
And I think it's probably time for the takeaway, which I mean, I think the takeaway is really short. Yeah, lots of blending in sake, always has been.
Try it.
That's
It's
it.
really good. It's really good as
Sake is
well.
good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
mean,
So.
you can do some with a beverage as versatile as sake. It is wide open for blending, and that is why the Japanese noticed. So
They've had a
a
thousand
long
years
time
to do
ago.
it.
Yeah.
Right. So, do you have a recommendation?
This would be silly if I said anything else at this point. My
Sure.
recommendation is Kenbishi.
Sure.
It has to be Kenbishi.
Right.
It's such a brilliant system of making sake. I appreciate it more and more every day that I spend here, and the more and more I learn about it. Their blending to me is very reminiscent of whiskey. Some of their brands, the way they do it, you know, where they have for example, Mizuho is 2 years and above. That means the minimum age is 2 years. But above that, it's anyone's guess. There could be 15, even 20-year-old sake in there. But it's going to depend on the blender each year. Zuisho, I believe, is 5 years. So that's the minimum. So this is very reminiscent of how the rules are stated under whiskey law. So these are the tax rules. You know, Scotch whiskey is 3 years and above. That is the minimum, and it has to be 3 years within casks and what have you. So, but yeah, I'm going to go specifically for Kenbishi. I'm going to go with the old faithful Kuramatsu. It's just, I think maybe you've recommended it before, but we'll forget that
Yeah.
for tonight. It's going to get a second
It'll give
recommendation.
a pass, yeah.
It's just, to me, it's the textbook definition of a versatile sake. You can put it into any situation, and you're going to have a good time with it. You can have it with food, you can have it on its own, you can heat it, you can chill it, you can have it at room temperature. So yeah, Kenbishi Kuramatsu, give it a try. It's a fantastic blended sake.
Absolutely. Agreed. Fantastic. So I'm going to go a little bit closer to home for myself, and I'm going to recommend Miyoshi Hana from Abunotsurushuzo in Abucho, over near Hagi on the Japan seaside of the island. this is one of the more interesting takes on blending that I have seen just personally. So what it is, in 2020, they brewed a tank of Junmai Ginjo, or Junmai Dai Ginjo, I guess it would technically be, and they set some aside. They released it as the 2020 version, and then the next year, 2021, they took some of that 2020 sake that had been aging for a year and blended it with a fresher tank of 2021 Junmai Dai Ginjo. Then they did the same thing in 2022. They used that 2020 base, some 2022, and they did that. They've been doing that every year since. They're planning to finish. He's planning. It's really only one guy. He's planning to finish in 2025, right? So, it's just a fascinating project because he's taking the sake that's aging, it's different every year, and he's blending it with a fresh batch of sake, which is also going to be different every year, right? It's small batch sake. You never know how the rice is going to be each year, and so every expression every year is going to be different. And he's doing it. He's adjusting, right? He's tasting the sake, the fresh sake. He's tasting the aged sake, considering how they would work together to create something new. And I think that's a just a beautiful expression. And what's more, not only is it a blend of different aged sake, but it's a blend of different polished sake. The Kojimai is 40%, the Kakemai is 50%, which is something he does a lot in his brewery. So that's a different style of blend that's also expressed. Miyoshi Hana. And as far as which one goes, yeah, just try whichever one for that year. It's always going to be different. It's never going to be the same experience twice.
But yeah, that sounds fantastic. I've got a guy I know down in Yamaguchi, so maybe he'll send me a bottle. Who
We'll
knows?
see if I stumble across a couple of bottles, see if I can finagle that. But I've only ever had it at like Matsuri and events and stuff. I've never actually bought a bottle. Yes, it was delicious. Nice sort of aged notes, nice sort of very big aromatics with that nice with that heart of flavor that I think is really important when it comes to any sake.
And importantly, I bet it wasn't a fluke.
Nope. No, not just throwing it together, see what happens. A very well planned, well balanced, well developed idea. Beautiful labels too. So, all right. So I think that brings us to the end of another episode of Sake Deep Dive. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We want to send out special thanks to our Patreon patrons. Yeah, y'all really do make this a much more rewarding progress process to keep going through every month. Gets us through this rough, irritating research sometimes.
Yeah, we earned our money tonight.
We did indeed. Yeah, our Patreon is up at patreon.com/sakedeepdive, all one word. If you want to check in and see if how you can keep us on it, we do appreciate it. We're coming up on our third ever sake matsuri this summer. Still in the planning stages, but keep your ears open for more information on that. You can find me, Jim Ryan, on my website, www.jimrion.com. Andrew, where can they find you?
On my website, www.originsake.com.
Right. Thanks again for listening. Keep those tokuri filled in your ochoko warm, but drink responsibly. Kanpai.
Kanpai.